Howdy, and welcome to the Breakaway Podcast. Thanks for listening. Breakaway is a Bible study that meets on the campus of Texas A&M. For more information on Breakaway, please visit breakawayministries.org. We hope you enjoy the talk.
It can be so hard to let go. There is a godly impulse in parents to protect and to provide for our kids. And it's difficult when the reality sets in that that instinct to protect and care for can actually do damage if held on to for too long. And there are statistics ad infinitum, and I'm sure you've heard them, that over-parenting into the 20s can cause depression in students. Or the most recent one I read from the Journal of Child and Family Studies found that college students who experience helicopter parenting report higher levels of depression, use of antidepressants, and it interferes with their development of competence and decreases their ability to complete tasks without parental supervision. There is a difficulty that can happen if we as parents try to do what some of us feel so natural, and that is to try to parent and protect them for too long. It can do damage in the life of our students, and yet that leads us to a place of then how? How do we turn loose the person we love into a world that we know is dangerous and problematic? Or as a student, how do we enter into a world that we know is dangerous without the protection of our parents that has gotten very comfortable, right? Well, I'll tell you what my heartbeat is for tonight. It's not to give you seven happy steps for releasing your child. I don't think any of us need that. And truthfully, I don't think that many of us are really helicopter parents like this. There's probably, I don't know, maybe one in here, and that video was for you, so be blessed. But the rest of us, we know what it is to turn our student loose and trust them to make their own decisions. But I just wonder if it diminishes at all the fear. As we turn them loose, how do you deal with the fear? I mean, you can try to not see that the world's a hard place and deny reality, or try to close your heart and just say, I don't care what happens to their lives. But if you're going to keep your eyes open to the reality that the world's tough and your heart open to love your kid, then how do you keep out the fear that can haunt us as we turn the person we love out into the world? And that's the question I want to come around tonight. And what's interesting is we read a psalm. We've been in the book of Psalms with our college students, and the psalm that we're in right now is Psalm 34, and it has a heading over it. In Psalm 34, the heading over it says, of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech, so that he drove him out and he went away. And I love the way the psalm writes that. It's so polite. Of David, when he changed his behavior before Abimelech. You can read about his change of behavior in 1 Samuel. What he was doing was slobbering down his beard while vandalizing the king's property. So that's a really polite way to say he went straight bonkers. So the text I chose for tonight is about a man in his 20s who starts acting crazy. So that's where I felt like we needed to go. But what's interesting is, as you come at it, what's happening in the life of King David, this main feature man in the Old Testament who wrote this poem that our students read earlier, it's interesting because this moment in his life, it highlights something that we know is coming, in one sense want to see come, but at the same time, we spend a lot of our time and energy and money avoiding. And that is what's happening in this moment in David's life is we watch a young person enter a crisis that his parents cannot step in and solve. And what's scary about it is it interrupts and agitates us as parents. I feel this as a parent because I know for my kid, I just want an uninterrupted boulevard of green lights for my kid, right? I just want a life that just kind of slowly lifts to awesomeness forever. And what's disturbing about the life of David as you read it is his life starts that way. I mean, he starts out, and as a young man, he gets a great job as a shepherd, you know, learning hard work and building character, and a holy man come and pronounces over him that he's special and he's going to be king, like happened to all your kids. And then he gets a great, starts playing the harp. He's working the extracurricular activities, looks great on the resume. He kills Goliath, which secures him a great internship in politics, and that turns into a job in the military. He marries into the royal family, and so his life is on the way up. It's looking amazing. He's a step away from the throne. And then all of a sudden, the king gets jealous of him. And in a moment in the book of 1 Samuel, you see the king try to kill David. And suddenly David loses his job. And then his wife betrays him. He loses his family. And then he loses his house. And he has to run. And he loses his best friend. And he loses his mentor. And he starts running through the desert for his life. And as he's out in the desert, he's without food and without provision. And in a moment of desperation, he goes to Gath. Gath, the hometown of Goliath, who he killed and then cut his head off. And when David shows up there, they recognize him. And they bring him before the king, Abimelech. And they said, this is the guy they've been singing about who's been killing our people. And David lands in a moment where all of a sudden he realizes, I am but a hair's breadth from death. And you see this guy whose life was on an upward trajectory suddenly find himself in a very, very difficult place. And God does it to him on purpose. Now, there's a lot of things in David's life that don't connect with our students. You haven't been killing giants and those sorts of things. But the truth is, we're all pretty talented, pretty remarkable students in here, but we're going to hit moments that are very difficult in life. And as parents, as much as I hate to say it, as I look into the face of my kids, I know they're going to enter difficult moments in life. And what I wonder as a parent, and I think maybe you do too, is how can we get comforted in that moment? How do we block out the fear that wants to grip us as we see our child goes through difficult moments in life? What comfort can the Bible give us as we watch this young man go through trials? And the most interesting thing happens as we enter into this song. What we find out is he wrote this song after that encounter with Abimelech. And what you see as you read this song in verse 1, he says, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul makes its boast in the Lord. Let the humble hear and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name forever. And what you get is not a scared psalm, not a frightened psalm. You get a happy song. You get a celebration song. And you go, what happened? And you find out in verse 4, he says, because I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from my fears. And if you read the text in 1 Samuel, you go, that seeking of the Lord must have happened pretty fast because they pulled him in front of the king and said, this is the guy. And it must have been like, God, please help me right now, right? And then he did the only thing he knew how to do, started acting crazy. And it's a great story because the king looks at his men and goes, do I not have enough local crazy? You're importing crazy into my kingdom? Get this guy out of here. And you see, they throw David out of town and he realizes, that worked. Unbelievable. And he starts writing a song about how that was jack crazy. And as he writes the song, you see in David's life joy that he says, I will boast in the Lord. I will magnify the Lord. I'll exalt in the Lord. You see a confidence in him. I'm going to boast. I'm going to tell everybody. But it's a confidence that has humility to it. He said, this poor man cried. Let the humble hear and be glad. And you see a concern for his peers. He says, I want you all to know what I found. If I was to ask you as parents, what do you hope is not true of your child? You would say, I don't want my child to be sad, arrogant, insecure, or self-absorbed. And what you see in David is he's the opposite of those things. He is joyful, humble, confident, and concerned for his peers. And all of that came into David's life, not in spite of this crisis, but because of it. His movement through this crisis wrought some beautiful things in the heart of David. And we all know this. We all know crisis is good for us. If I was to ask you, and we do this with our people sometimes, hey, draw 5 pictures of key moments in your life that shaped you as a human being. If I asked you to do that, I would guess that at least 2, probably 3 and more of the key moments that you would say define me as a human being and built some beautiful things in me would be moments that you would say were hard moments. That I went through something difficult, but it birthed something good in me. We all know difficult things bring forth good. And we all know that people who are shielded from difficulty tend to grow up into shallow, entitled, basically insufferable people. And so we want our kids to be joyful and humble and confident. And the reality is God says, I want that too. So I will introduce into your child's life pain. Pain. And yet we can be comforted because we know he's doing it for four reasons. Something he wants to put in them and into us. Number one, God will introduce pain into your child's life, into your life, because one, he wants you to see that life is hard. He wants you to see it. Because the reality is when we get going on our merry way, sometimes we can get a little narrow view of our life and miss out on the reality that the world is a difficult place. And we can get infatuated or obsessed with things that in the big scheme of things don't really matter. And so sometimes God in love will have to smack us to wake us up to the fact that the world is a hard place. I remember for me a few years ago, I hurt my back and I was in tremendous pain, was losing the use of my right leg. And I remember going to the doctor and I said to him, hey, look, Breakaway's about to start in a couple weeks. We need to get this done because I'm trying to get this lined up. We got to get this video done. I got to do this promo deal. I got to work on my sermon. So whatever surgery you need to do, can we just go ahead and make this happen now? Because I got to go. And I remember him looking at me and going, let me acclimate you to a new reality. He said, I don't know if you're going to be able to use that leg again. He said, because of some complications with your back, I don't know that there's any way to fix it. He said, and if your foot drops, which it's in dangerous place of doing, he says, you will never be the same. And he said, so let me tell you right now, my wife was pregnant at the time. He said, you won't be able to help her. You won't be able to hold that baby. And I can't promise you anything. And he sent me home with hope that your back fixes itself. And I remember laying on the floor in my house and realizing so many of the things that I was obsessed with are now in a distant second. And as I sat there, I thought about my pain. And just to be honest with you, I had some self-pity moments that were pretty epic in the world of self-pity. But I remember I hit a moment where I just was crying out to God about the pain of it. And for a moment, I just stopped. And I just felt like I had this sweet moment with the Lord where it just occurred to me, my pain is real, but honestly, it's not even in the top 10 of horrible things human beings are suffering on the planet right now. And as I moved through hospitals and rehabs and got the use of this leg back, but began to traffic in this world of pain, I realized there's a lot of people out there with a lot of deep needs, and some of the things I was worried about are just so small. And so sometimes God will give us the gift of pain to open our eyes to see the world is a hard place, that there really are what David calls in verse 4, fears, literally terrors, that there really are in verse 6, troubles, difficult things. In verse 19, he says, many are the afflictions of the righteous. God says, even if you're a good person, that doesn't exempt you from tragedy. Actually, if you try to live a right life before God, it will probably introduce more affliction into your life. And yet God wants us to get our head around the fact that, hey, the world we live in is beautiful, but it's broken. There's something wrong here. I read a book by a survivalist, and they asked him, in desperate situations, POW camps, who are the first to die? And he said, oh, that's easy, the optimists. And they said, what do you mean? And he said, the people that just keep saying, I bet we get saved tomorrow, I'm sure we'll be home by Christmas, the people who are just unwilling to admit the world is hard, they just try to live with this shallow veneer of, everything's happy, everything's okay, and as that veneer melts away, they go, and don't have any other option but to fade away. And he said, so the people that kind of have a disengagement from reality don't make it. And so God in his mercy brings some pain in to wake us up to the reality that life is hard. And not only that life is hard, he wants us to see life as hard and to know that we're insufficient, that we're not God, that we can't control things, that there are problems in our life that we can't get ourselves out of, which is crazy to hear because all of us on our way here, when you graduated high school, were given the book, Oh, the Places You'll Go. And as you read that book, it told you that all you need is the brain in your head and the feet in your shoes, and you can steer yourself in any direction you choose. But I'm here to tell you that's not exactly true. I say to you, it's not. I mean, read the Bible, verse 10. It says, young lions suffer want and hunger. If anyone gets in a fight with a young lion's going to win. He picks the toughest animal out there, the strongest animal out there. It rules some of the most dangerous places. Young lions can get things done, but what young lions can't do is produce meat where there isn't any. So a young lion can do a lot, but if there's no antelope, young lion becomes dead lion pretty fast. And we are young lions in here. I mean, Aggies, we got voted this year the happiest and the fittest campuses in the nation. Young lions, man. You guys can do so much. And sometimes that can get in your head of like, I can do anything. And I've been to graduations where they read the poem over and over again. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll, right? I am the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul. False. No. Yes, you can determine how you'll react to situations, but you can't determine the situations you're in. And I've talked to many, I've talked to a few young soldiers who are so powerful, so strong, so well-trained, but they've been put in situations where none of that was sufficient to save their life. And that's the reality. And so God puts David, and he'll put us in moments where we see that life is hard and know that we're not sufficient to handle it. Even the young lions will suffer want and hunger. And you go, well, Ben, none of this is great news. How did you make such an upbeat psalm so depressing? Well, if you notice, that's where it starts. It starts with a sense of our limits. It starts with a sense of our desperation. But what happens is from that place, it opens our eyes and we get to see this world is a hard place and we know I'm not sufficient to solve all the problems. But then we get to see that there's a God who reigns over it. That the good news for the Christian, that what David gets to see in this passage is this world is really hard. This pain is real. But as I see this pain, I cry out and I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from my fears. This poor man cried out and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. It's interesting. I read an article this month in the New York Times. It was by a guy, David Brooks, and he was writing about making a moral bucket list. And he said, periodically in my journeys as a writer, he said, I come across people that aren't just like a good guy. They are an inspirational human being. He said, someone whose inner light radiates. And he said, I realized those people, he said, they have something that many don't. He said, there's two kinds of virtues in the world. He said, there's resume virtues and there's eulogy virtues. He said, resume virtues are we get the things in our life and in our toolkit that'll help us get a good job and make that money and right and be a success. And certain manners of speaking. He said, but there's a whole different set of virtues that you talk about at someone's funeral. When you're at their funeral, you talk about a whole different set of things. Did they have a selfless love? Were they generous? Were they compassionate? You talk about things that, honestly, you don't get in a textbook at most colleges. And so he said, I wanted to know, how do I get those? How do I be not just a decent guy, not just a successful worker, but how do I be a beautiful human being? And he said, I just started to go around to the people I saw who radiated light. And he said, you know what came out of all of them? Humility. He said, I saw that in the culture of the big me, the meritocracy to prove yourself, the social media to broadcast the highlight reel of your life, he said, the most beautiful people were the people who realized they're small, realized they were humble, and they needed help. That they saw this world is a dark place, and yet within me there's a yearning for more. And as they yearn for more, they realize, why do I long for beauty in a world filled with so much pain? Because I've been made for beauty, because I've been made for wonder, because the world was beautiful, and the world will be again. And there's a God over this, and pain is not the end of our story. The good news is that the Christian does not have to be a pessimist. Nor do they have to be a blind optimist. They can be a realist and say the world is really a dark place, but there's really a God who rules over it. And as I look to him, I see a God who's over this, and I know that he is sufficient. that when I seek the Lord, he answers me and delivers me from my fears. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried out. The Lord heard him and saved him out of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers him. What the psalmist found is when I see the world's hard and know my limitations, it forces me to look up and cry out for help. And as I do that, I see there's a God who rules over the pain, and I know he's sufficient to save. It's fascinating. I read a book by Ben Sherwood, not a Christian book. He's a writer for the LA Times, wrote a New York Times bestselling book called The Survivor's Club. And it's a book, it was a fascinating book. I highly recommend it. It's just all about survival. And he was just curious, like, who survives? Like, who survives in a plane crash? Which is basically the young who are in shape that are less than 12 rows away from the exit. Basically, that's who survives. Put that in your mind. I always sit by the exit now because I want to live, right? And it's just interesting stuff like that that I find fascinating, right? Left-handed people tend to die sooner because you right-handed people oppress us. So think about that. But he just writes interesting things like that. But then he enters into one chapter and he started it this way. He said, when I started writing this book, I was somewhat skeptical of the role of faith in survival. But as I began to interview survivors around the world, I noticed a remarkable pattern. Overwhelmingly, they shared that a belief in God and faith sustained them through their trials. As many as 75 or 80% cited a higher power as the reason for their survival. And over time, my incredulity proved no match for their conviction. Indeed, I began to feel admiration for their faith, and I envied their certitude. Military folks like to joke that there are no atheists in foxholes. When bullets fly, everybody prays. In the trenches of survival, it's the same. Many survivors are true believers. Either they face their crisis with strong faith, or they discover it in the crucible. But they all share a common perspective. God has a plan, and he gives them the strength to overcome. Then he tells a long and interesting story about meeting Ray Smith, who literally wrote the book, How to Survive on Land and Sea. And for 27 years, he taught at the military, at the Naval Survival Training Institute, about how to survive. The guy knows how to live. And as Ben Sherwood approached him, he said, I began with the simple question, what's the secret to survival? Without hesitating, he said, faith in God. Really? I asked. Absolutely. It's a major factor in all survival scenarios. Smith says this as a man whose close friends include some of America's most legendary ex-prisoners of war. Faith is a unifying force in all their experiences, he says, and he feels so strongly about this that he thinks faith properly belongs as the first chapter on any book on survival. In military parlance, he called it a force multiplier. It significantly increases and multiplies your strength and effectiveness. They said the people we see endure are the people who realize their insufficiency and find God in the midst of that. That's one of the gifts that pain gives us. It forces us to look up and see there's a bigger story with a big author, and I can link up to him and he can save. And what does it do for you? It brings joy. This poem's an acrostic. That's where you start with every letter of the alphabet. It's the Hebrew alphabet. So if you don't pick up on it, it's fine. But just trust me, in David's language, he says, I got to a point of desperation and I cried out to God for help and God met me there. And from A to Z, I'm thrilled. God is wonderful. And not only did it give him joy, it gave him humility. It gave him humility. He says, this poor man cried out. David got the liberty from trying to act like you are God. So many students, they wrestle not with just a narcissism. That's too shallow an analysis of millennials. It's not that. It's a sense of I have to control the world. I've been put in a place where I have to succeed. And when you realize you can't control every factor, you get depressed. You lose hope, lose perspective. What the Christian gets is they get to look and say, I'm not in control. I'm a poor man. And you get the humility that says, I'm not God. But I can know him. And it's a humility that doesn't just shrug its shoulders and go, oh, well. it's a humility that also brings with it a beautiful confidence. Because you say, I can't control everything, but I know the one who does. And he has shown me how to live, and I can walk with him. And that's why David says in verse 11, come, O children, listen to me. I'll teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is there who desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking deceit. Turn away from evil, do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Because the eye of the Lord is toward the righteous, his ear toward their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off their memory from the earth. He says, you know what? I have the humility to know I'm not in control, but I can know the God who is. And so I taste and see that he's good. How do you do that, David? I listen to what he says and I walk with him. And I find that many are the afflictions of the righteous. And yet God comes through, that there's a way through this life. And as I walk in God's way, he blesses me. He makes me humble, but also confident. He liberates me from the tyranny of self-absorption and lets me be someone who trusts him, so I can bless them and I can be a blessing to the world around me. How do we get rid of the fear? Is that in the middle of our desperation, we realize we have a God who sees us and cares about us and is sufficient for us, and he's not wasting our time. I've had the privilege in my life to hang out with a number of Navy SEALs. And in that, I remember visiting with one who was a good friend while he was going through BUDS. Basic underwater demolition SEAL training, that horrible process to become a SEAL. And I remember at one point I was talking to him during that grueling process to become one, and he was telling me about a trial that they were putting him through. And if you're not familiar with it, the attrition rate in the middle of BUDS is somewhere around 75%. Most people quit. And he said, Ben, they put us in a trial where, and just try to imagine this, he said, they made us lay down at the edge of a pool with our head leaning over the side, on our backs, back. He said, then they took our scuba masks, filled them with water, and attached them to our face. And they said, and then we had to clear the mask. And I said, how do you clear it? And he said, well, you relax and let the water run down your nose, through your throat, into your stomach. And as you ingest the water, you slowly clear your mask so you can see. And I said, well, how did that go? And he said, well, if you panic, your gag reflex kicks in right away and you vomit everywhere. So he said, within seconds, as we were laying shoulder to shoulder on the ground, the guys next to me gagged and we were just suddenly in a pool of vomit. And I said, that sounds horrible. And I remember asking him, I said, is this the worst experience you've ever been in your life? And I'll never forget, he said, no, it's awesome. And I said, you want to talk me through how laying in a pool of vomit, snorting water through your nose is awesome? Because I'm not getting it. And I'll never forget, he said, Ben, these instructors are not wasting my time. He said, I'm not in some like weird group that's like, I don't know, snort this. He said, I know that they're preparing me for life. He said, because the reality is on a mission, there's great likelihood that I'm in the middle of a mission and some explosion goes off that rips off my gear, and I have to be willing to and able to stay calm, put my gear on underwater, clear my mask, and keep moving forward. He said, what these guys are doing is uncomfortable, it's painful, but it's making me into the kind of man I want to be, to do the things I've been built to do. So I think it's awesome. They show me where I'm weak and show me a way forward, and I celebrate it. And that's what God does. And that's why we can be joyful, not fearful, when trials come in our life and into our children's life, because we know there's a God above them, above the pain, that the world is not in the hands of evil men. There's a God who rules over the pain, and he is sufficient, and he is strong, and he cares. And you may say, well, Ben, how do you know that? The text gives it to us. He says at the end, of the righteous, many are his afflictions. The Lord delivers him out of them all. He keeps all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Which at that point sounds like too big a promise. You go, so the person who trusts God never breaks a bone? I broke my femur in high school. So is this text saying that God hates me? If you have a broken collarbone, does that mean you need no longer apply? What's going on in this text?
Well, some old commentators say, well, maybe he is being a bit metaphoric. He talks about having your spirit crushed, and maybe he's talking about, though you may suffer greatly many of your afflictions, you won't ultimately be crushed. There will be vindication on the other end of it. But you go, but Ben, I know really great people who are dead. So what am I supposed to do with this psalm? Well, if there's confusion in it, it got solved about 1,000 years later when the only true righteous man lived the perfect life we could not, Jesus Christ. And then he who knew no sin, Jesus, became sin on that cross. Many were the afflictions of that righteous man that he took on ours. He took on our pain, our sin, our shame on that cross and suffered greatly, crying out to his Father in the midst of it. The Jewish people at that time wanted those who were being crucified in Rome off those crosses before the Sabbath day. So they asked Rome, will you break the legs of the men on those crosses so that they can no longer press up to breathe and so they'll die of asphyxiation? And Rome complied and began to move along, breaking the legs of the men who were crucified. And when they came to Jesus, he had already died. The massive loss of blood from the scourging he'd received earlier, I think, is what did the trick. And so they didn't break his legs. They didn't have to. They pierced his side and saw the blood and water flow out, and they said, he's done. And John saw that and said, that was to fulfill Psalm 34. That's the righteous man whose bones won't be broken. And so he went through affliction. His affliction took him all the way to the grave. You go, where was God's salvation then? God rescues the afflicted. What happened to Jesus? The Christian has a longer view than death. You might go all the way to the grave, but the good news of Christianity is the grave is not the end for us. That we may have problems and trials in this life that take from us our health, take from us our joy for a season, take from us a loved one. We may have trials in this life that take from us, but no one takes more than death. It takes all and gives nothing back. And yet one man, the one righteous man, Jesus Christ, faced death for us. And then he rose afterwards and he beat the great enemy, death. And he says, all who follow me, many will be your afflictions. Troubles will come and death will come. But the good news for the Christian is death is not the end. We rise. We see that we're weak. We know we're insufficient. And yet we see a God who is mighty and we know that he saves. And that's why we can be joyful no matter what this world brings, because we know the one who came for us. And his name's Jesus. I pray if you don't know him that you might even tonight. And if you do, that you'll smile when trouble comes because you know, I know him and he knows me. And in that, there is joy. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good.
Well, howdy, and welcome to the Breakaway Podcast. My name is Hannah, and I'm sitting here with Ben Stewart on a Saturday night. You may think, what? It's not Tuesday night. No, we had Parents Breakaway this weekend, and so we had tons of parents and their students come in and get to worship with us and hear from God's Word, and it was a really, really sweet time. I know that I witnessed several parents and students at the end of it praying with each other and crying and just really praising the Lord together. And it was, it got me teary-eyed. I mean, it was a sweet moment. And so it was a fun night. I think parents really enjoyed it, I hope. Mm-hmm. And it was just a great night.
Totally. Well, and for, I mean, obviously, if you're listening to this, well, not obviously, maybe if you're listening to this, you weren't here with us. So let me fill you in on one, Jeff Johnson's leadership of worship was phenomenal.
Really good.
And then we lead a prayer moment at the end where we invite families to circle up and pray together. And so, you know, some families, that's a pretty normal occurrence. Some of them, and we hear the stories every year, we've made this a priority to do at Parents Weekend. It's the first time their families ever prayed together. And then you never know at what point in between those two extremes people are. And so that prayer moment at the end, so special. And it was special this year too. And One other thing you may have missed is we showed a video too before my talk started to kind of illustrate helicopter parenting. It was from Portlandia. I think it was the first one from season two. I certainly would not endorse everything Portlandia does, so don't hear this as that. But it was a funny sketch about two parents basically trying to run their kid's life to keep him from any pain at all. So it was a bit humorous to show him Parents Weekend over the top and then got us into the topic. So yeah, it was fun. Great.
Well, it was a good night. Did you have some more thoughts from your talk, Ben?
Well, you know, I would just say not a whole lot. There's obviously more going on with that psalm, and there's always more you can dig into, but I don't know that there's any more to say about it at this point other than, you know, obviously the Bible takes up the subject of suffering a lot. It's a major issue in the world. If there's a good God, why suffering, you know? And the world isn't what it should be, but that's the good news of the gospel. We're beautiful in the image of God. Everything's broken because of sin. And yet God is on the move making things right through Jesus. And so that's our story. That's our message. So it shows up all through the Bible. We've done some longer treatments on trials and suffering in other places. I would point you to, we did a series on the book of James. We also did a book on James. This Changes Everything, if you want the Bible study we wrote. So that's shameless promotion there. But obviously the book of James in the Bible talks more about trials and suffering. And so our podcasts are available. You can check that out. Or if you want to check out the book, This Changes Everything, that talks a little more about it. And then if you're into the life of David, you know, a lot of people have done the life of David. I think we did a series on it years ago. I think the podcast is down though, because it was back when our sound quality was haywire. But but honestly, Chuck Swindoll wrote a great book on the life of David. If you're like, I want to get into this, there's multiple psalms that connect into parts of David's life that you get this beautiful opportunity to watch a man of God struggle and read his journal in the book of Psalms. So it's pretty amazing. So if you want to get deeper in the Psalms, deeper in the life of David, who wrote many of them, Chuck Swindoll has a book on the life of David that's really helpful and really great. And there's some other commentaries, but I would recommend that one. I thought it was so good. Yeah. And that's it.
Awesome. Well,
be good parents.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we loved having those parents and their students with us tonight. It was a good night.
That's right.
We won't be here this coming Tuesday, the 21st. There will be muster.
That's right.
So do not come to Reed Arena next Tuesday. You will not see any of us.
Or come early to muster.
Or come early for muster.
If you come at 9, you'll be watching people leave muster or
That's
something.
Right.
But come early if you want to.
Yeah, go to muster.
Yeah, but we won't be here.
Yeah, and then the next Tuesday, the 28th, we will have another breakaway. Then it'll be the last podcast talk kind of breakaway.
That's right.
And then the Tuesday after that, we'll be closing up with an all worship with Jeff. So make sure and come out.